As we move on in our study on dispensations, we're moving to the dispensation of law this morning. It takes up a large portion of the Old Testament and probably is one of the areas that a lot of Christians struggle with, trying to understand exactly what is being said. If we kind of look at our timeline that we have here, we've so far looked at Adam in the garden, and then Adam and Eve being kicked out of the garden, their expulsion, their life, man's life then on the earth. Following Eden, following the fall, man's life with a conscience. We don't have this called conscience, we just call it after Eden. And it ended in failure, which we saw. And as a result, God directed Noah to build the ark and destroyed everybody except for the eight people that were on the ark. And then we move into the time in which the Tower of Babel was built. And we've looked at this. We moved in the time of Abraham. And now we're moving out to the time of law. The time of law extends from the time that God brings Israel out of Egypt until the day of Pentecost. So it's about 1,500 years, roughly, this period of time. With every one of these dispensations, as we've been considering, God is the household owner. He's the master of the house. He's the one, if you look with me in Exodus chapter 20, look with me at verse 1 and 2. Exodus 20, verses 1 and 2, it says, "Then God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." So God's the one that's going to be giving these instructions. If you turn over to chapter 24. Again, chapter 24 and verse 3. And it says, "And Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words that the Lord has spoken we will do." It's important we look at this because this seems to be the same thing that they say back in Exodus chapter 19, but it is not, because over there, God hadn't asked him to do anything except guard his covenant. Now he's actually given them commands, and they had been failing and presumed that they could do anything that God asked of them, where in reality they hadn't. And then just as a reminder, we're not going to go there, but over in Hebrews chapter 3, Paul says that the builder of all things is God. God is always the master of the house because he's the builder of all things. And we saw that in Hebrews chapter 3. Interestingly enough, over there, where God the Son is equated with the builder, he is God. But Paul already established that in the book of Hebrews back in chapter 1. So, God is the owner. He's the one that speaks with Moses. He's the one that speaks the words to the people. And, of course, he's the one that builds the house in which Moses is a slave. Moses is the steward. He's the one that is going to be in charge. He's going to be the manager, okay, in this case. So back, if you flip back just a few pages to Exodus chapter 19, Exodus 19, after the people presumed that they can do all that the Lord has spoken, verse 9, "And the Lord said to Moses, behold, I shall come to you in a thick cloud, in order that the people may hear when I speak with you, may also believe in you forever. And then Moses told the words of the people to the Lord." So Moses is going to be the go-between. He's going to be the one that's going to be in charge of communicating these words from God to the people, and then whatever the people happen to say, taking those things back to God. And if you look over back where we were just a moment ago in chapter 24 of Exodus, in verse 12, it says, "Now the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and remain there, and I will give you the stone tablets with the law and the commandments which I have written for their instruction." It's very interesting. Everybody else is excluded on the mountain. God has been accessible. He's been there in the midst doing these different things for the people until they presume that they can do anything. And immediately, God now is going to show them how hard it is to come into his presence. And he's actually going to draw a line. It says anybody that comes up and even touches the mountain, even a person or an animal, they're going to die. They're going to die. With the exception of Moses. He's going to call Moses to come up on the mountain. Moses is also going to bring an assistant along. It's going to be a Joshua eventually is participating in these things, but Aaron, or excuse me, but Moses is the manager. He's the one that God is speaking with. In fact, look at this very interesting statement over in Exodus chapter 33. Exodus chapter 33. Start with me in verse 7. It says, "Now Moses used to take the tent and pitch it outside the camp." Now that's the tent. When the kids are looking at the Ark of the Covenant, this model that we have, this cardboard model of the Ark of the Covenant, when they're looking at that, that was put inside a tent. There was a large tent that God instructed Moses how it was to be built, and then Moses had different people from the people of Israel build this tent, and it was a very large tent, very thick tent, and it had a front room that they would walk in, and then it had this back room in which the ark was. So it tells us here that he would pitch this tent outside the camp, a good distance from the camp. He called it the tent of meeting. Why? Well, because it's the place at which they're going to meet with God. And it came about that everyone who sought the Lord would go out to the tent of meeting, which was outside the camp. So this is where they would come out there to seek. Came about whenever Moses went out to the tent that all the people would rise and stand, each at the entrance of his tent, and gaze after Moses until he entered the tent. Came about whenever Moses entered the tent, the pillar of cloud would descend and stand at the entrance of the tent, and the Lord would speak with Moses. And when all the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, all the people would arise and worship each at the entrance of his tent. Thus the Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, just as a man speaks to his friend. When Moses returned to the camp, his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, would not depart from the tent. Joshua is rather enthralled with what's happening in the tent and doesn't really want to depart. But Moses, being not only just what we would consider the manager or steward, and that he is, but one enjoying this relationship with God so much that he's able to describe it here as one man speaking with his friend, two friends speaking with each other. Turn with me over to Numbers chapter 12. Numbers chapter 12. Numbers 12, look with me, beginning with verse 1. "Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, 'Well, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us as well?' And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was more humble than any man who was on the face of the earth. And suddenly the Lord said to Moses and Aaron and to Miriam, 'You three come out to the tent of meeting.' So the three came out. The Lord came down in the pillar of cloud, stood at the doorway of the tent, and he called Aaron and Miriam. When they had both come forward, he said, 'Hear now the words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, shall make myself known to him in a vision. I shall speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my household.'" See, this is exactly what Paul refers to in Hebrews chapter 3. "With him I speak mouth to mouth, face to face, we would say, even openly and not in dark sayings," not in visions, as he was saying there, "not in dreams." Tells you that sometimes you see these things. An example of a vision is John writing the book of Revelation. Now, I'm not saying that anything John wrote was inaccurate, but it is interesting when John writes that John says, "I looked and I saw something like." In other words, God isn't telling him this is what you're going to see. Or God isn't telling John this. John is telling us what he sees. Now, does the Holy Spirit oversee that? Absolutely. The Holy Spirit is guiding what he's writing. But John is saying, this is what it looks like, which means that sometimes when we read some of the images in the book of Revelation, we're like, what is that? I wonder what that is. And, of course, you have people that have all kinds of guesses and such. But that's the nature of a vision or a dream, is that what you're seeing, it doesn't necessarily mean you know exactly what's going on. But he says that's different. He says, "With Moses, I speak openly. I speak not in dark sayings. He beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant, against Moses?" So Moses is God's steward. He's the one that God's chosen to impart the law through him. He's a channel, a vehicle through which God's going to impart the law to the people of Israel. Now, the people of Israel, they are the household. I can't probably emphasize this enough, and the reason for that is because there are many people today that think we are under the law. And not just people, whether Seventh-day Baptists or Seventh-day Adventists, or whatever group, there are many people. There are many people that would seem in many ways they would agree with us on many aspects of truth, but they do think that we are under law in some form. And of course, we can tell by the fights around our country in different places where there are people that think the Ten Commandments ought to be posted in public places and in public courthouses. Why? Because we think that that's a positive moral influence that we need to maintain someplace here, because many of those people still think that that's a good guide. In fact, I've heard many Christians say, well, we're not under the law, but the law is still a good guide for us. It's a good principle. And in reality, they don't really understand how the law works when they say that. They almost treat the law as though it's just good moral advice, which the law was never just good moral advice. So in Exodus chapter 34, verse 27, and the Lord said to Moses, write down these words, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. See, Israel are the people that are going to receive the covenant. Verse 28, so he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He did not eat bread or drink water. Don't know how that happened, but that's what God says. And he wrote on the tablet the words of the covenant, the 10 commandments, these 10 sayings that are going to be involved in this. Book of Deuteronomy, when it repeats this in chapter 4, says that these were written on two tablets of stone. Now, when we looked in the ark here that the Garniks made for us, inside there they had the tablets of the law. And we don't know how large these tablets were. Maybe that's the size they were. But God had inscribed these 10 sayings, these 10 words or sayings on those tablets of stone, front and back, by the way. He had inscribed them. And those were, in part, the words of the covenant. They were the part of the main stipulation of the covenant. Now, the rest of the law broke out and explained the rest of that covenant, but those were the initial statements of that covenant, which was very important for them in that context. God made this covenant with Israel when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. He didn't make with their fathers. And I think it's very important that we understand this. Turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 5. We will touch on this in more detail later. But the law, God did not give the law to mankind. He gave it to Israel. And he didn't give it to Israel through all of history. He didn't give it until this point, about 1500 BC. He began working with Abraham shortly after about 2000 BC. So about 500 years have transpired with God working with these people of Israel without the law. And now he's going to bring the law and bring it into effect. And so in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 1, then Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I am speaking today in your hearing, that you may learn them and observe them carefully. The Lord your God made a covenant with us in Horeb. That's over in that area where Sinai was located down there. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even those alive here today. The Lord spoke to you face to face on the mountain from the midst of the fire, while I was standing between the Lord and you at that time, to declare to you the word of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire and did not go up the mountain. He said, excuse me, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And then he goes through and delineates the law. But he says, I didn't make this with your fathers. And he's not saying, oh, not with your specific moms and dads that have died in the wilderness over the last 40 years. No, he's saying, not with the fathers, not with Abraham, not with Isaac, not with Jacob, not with Joseph, not with any of Joseph's brothers. He made it with you people, the people that came out of Egypt. You're the ones that he has given the law to. in addition to not giving the law to the people before this, if you look back a chapter in chapter 4 and verse 8, he begins to talk to them in verse 6 saying, you are to keep and do them, for that is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who will hear all these statutes, say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. This is if they would have actually done the law, which God knows they're not going to. For what great nation is there that has a God so near as to it as the Lord our God whenever we call on him? Or what great nation is there that has statutes and judgments as righteous as this whole law, which I'm setting before you today? In other words, the nations, if Israel were to live by the law, they would have been different. And if they would have been different and would have enjoyed God's blessings, and God would have been among them all that time. Remember, he departed. He departed prior to the destruction of Jerusalem when Babylon came. He departed. Ezekiel showed, got to see that vision of the departure of the glory from the temple. And it, to our knowledge, I don't know that the glory ever returned. But they got to see this. They got to witness this. This glory among them. And if they would have been living as God intended under the law, then guess what? The peoples around them would have said, huh, this is really a different nation. And look at their gods right there. There's this unusual pillar that's above the structure where they go to worship him, where they go to do sacrifices and bring offerings. And they're unusually healthy and unusually agriculturally productive. That was would have been their main line of work, would have been agriculture. And we just can't ever defeat them. We go up against them, they chase us several different directions as we have to scatter. And we've seen a little bit of their law. We've heard a little bit about them, and it's so unusual. In other words, all that stands out because why? Why would the nation say that? Because he hadn't given the law to them. He says, I'm giving it to you. And other nations will, at a distance, observe it. They'll see it. I mean by observe it, see it with you. But they themselves aren't given this law. We'll come back to this point at a later point in our study. Not today, but down the road. But I think it's very important for us to understand he made this covenant. He made this covenant with these people, with the household of Israel. He made this covenant not with their fathers that preceded them, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and his sons. And he did not make it with the nations that were around them. He made it with these people starting at this point. This is the point at which the law takes hold. This is the point at which God actually gives to them the law. Turn with me over to the book of 2 Chronicles, chapter 6. 2 Chronicles, chapter 6, as they dedicate the temple. 2 Chronicles, chapter 6, and verse 11, it says, and there I have set the ark in which is the covenant of the Lord, which he made with the sons of Israel. See, he made that covenant with them. He didn't make it with the nations. In fact, flip with me for a moment. We'll come back here to Deuteronomy in just a little bit. But flip with me to Acts chapter 14. Acts chapter 14. This is not, I didn't include this on your outline. It might be an addition you might want to make. But Acts chapter 14 and verse 16, as Paul is speaking to these people to get to the point of sharing with them, he says, who in the generations past has allowed or permitted all the nations, all these Gentiles, to go their own way? See, despite what sometimes we're taught, God had not given an eternal moral code to mankind. He had not implemented a moral code on mankind. He had not given this law to mankind. He gave it to Israel. And the rest of the nations, he let them go their own way. Because he was going to use Israel to teach something. He was going to use Israel to make a point. And that point, the book of Romans tells us, was to show us that we all are sinners. So what was it? What was this like? What can we say about what this life under law was like? What were they actually supposed to do? Well, go back to Deuteronomy now. Back to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4, they were to obey the law. And so he says, "Now, O Israel," this is verse 1, "O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I am teaching you, and do them." The American Standard translates this, "perform." "Do them in order that you may live and go in and take possession of the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you. You shall not add to the word which I am commanding you, nor shall you take away from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God which I command you." So they weren't supposed to, we're supposed to add, not take away. There's a law. It's exactly the way God gave it. They didn't need anything else. Look on down here as he continues through here. Verse 6, which we've already looked at. It says, "So keep and do them." The word "keep" there is the word that we oftentimes get confused by, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, this particular concept of keep. This word that he uses here in the Hebrew has the idea of to guard it or to keep it safe. We have a similar idea that we've looked at in the New Testament scriptures too. So they are to be guarding the commandments. They're to be guarding the law. How do you guard it? To make sure nobody adds or takes away from it, which we saw previously. Somebody comes along and says, "Hey, I think we need this in the law. I want something about this. No amendments. God said what he said. I don't like that part. Let's have a constitutional convention and let's excise that." Nope. You don't take away from it. You're also going to guard it by making sure that it's carried out properly. I'll give you the illustration here on this, and I think that this had to be one of the harder things to do. But under the law, if you had a son, and I don't think probably when it said son, that meant a 10-year-old. I don't think most likely that's probably what it was referring to, but who knows? Maybe even at the age of 10, a son distinguished himself as being exceptionally rebellious. Well, let's say you had a son that was very dishonoring, very rebellious and dishonoring to his parents. Those parents were to take that son or that child before the elders of the city, and they were to tell the people, "Our son is rebellious and he dishonors us." And those parents then, along with the other people in that wherever they lived there, were to take up stones and throw stones at this son until he died. They were to kill him. That'd be hard to be a parent to do that. I always wonder sometimes if that was one of the built-in weaknesses in the law, that nobody wanted to kill anybody else. Because it could be me next. But especially if it was your child. I mean, I think we can probably get this because we live in a culture all the time where we have some real horrible children that are just monsters to their parents, and their parents just maybe yell at their kids. That's all they do. But they do nothing about it. And oftentimes, I don't think those situations get better. I think they just get worse and worse over time. They were to guard the law by making sure these things happen. In fact, as my wife and I have been reading through the law at the present time, that happens to be where we're in our Bible reading, came across some of these statements in the law where it says that they were to put different people to death under these different circumstances, and so they were to be removing far from them this evil. So in other words, rebellion that is tolerated doesn't breed peace, it breeds more rebellion and more rebellion and more rebellion, and it gets worse and worse and worse, and they were to expel this from their midst. And so when he talks about guarding there, keeping them, guarding, that meant that they were to make sure, hey, wait a second, what that guy did, he was supposed to pay back to that man double what he stole. Well, we're not going to do that to him. Don't you think that's a little extreme? That's what God told us. Hey, that guy did something worthy of a capital crime. Yeah, but he's my buddy. Hey, it's a capital crime. It's what God told us in the law. And they were to guard it. They were to guard the law. It's one of the things that they were supposed to do. They were to walk. Look in chapter 5. Look in chapter 5 and verse 33. It says that they were to You shall walk in all the way which the Lord your God has commanded you, that you may live, and that it may be well with you, and that you may prolong your days in the land which you shall possess. In other words, if they would obey the law, they'd be healthy. Life in the land would go well. And they'd live a long time in that land. I always think it's interesting that it would go well, that they'd be healthy, that they'd live a long time. All those go together. Because to live a long time in a state of extreme poverty or distress, or live to a very long time, very old, and yet have tremendous amount of illnesses, pains, and sicknesses, both of those are not particularly desirable. And so God promised real blessing for these people at that time, which we eventually will delineate a little bit more. They were, if you turn back, flip back over to the book of Deuteronomy, book of Numbers, pardon me, in chapter 3. Numbers chapter 3, verse 10. Numbers 3 and verse 10, notice he says, "So you shall appoint Aaron and his sons that they may keep their priesthood, but the layman, the stranger, the non-Levite, the one who hasn't descended from the family of Aaron, who comes near, he shall be put to death." You got somebody else that comes along? Hey, we want to be priests. It's not fair that only Aaron and his sons get to be priests, and his grandsons and so on and so forth. Put them to death when they come near and try to do that. So only that family, that will be important for Israel's history down the road. This was part of their law. Not only were the priests in Aaron's family to be the priests, but if you flip back to Deuteronomy in chapter 12, Deuteronomy chapter 12, beginning with verse 1, it says, "These are the statutes and the judgments which you are to carefully observe in the land which the Lord your God, the God of your fathers, has given you to possess. As long as you live on the earth, you will utterly destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. And you shall tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and burn their asherim with fire. And you shall cut down their engraved images of their gods, and you shall obliterate their name from that place. And you shall not act like this towards your Lord, but you shall seek him at the place which the Lord your God shall choose from all your tribes to establish his name there for his dwelling, and there you shall come." In other words, God says, "I'm going to choose the place. You're going to come there. You're not going to be like these Gentile nations that you're going to be killing and wiping out, who went up on top of all of these hills ever." Think of, they're entering a land, and all around them, every time there's a little high spot, a little hill around there, they could look up there and they could see that these people had planted trees and had erected these images and pillars up there, and they had altars, and they went up all over and worshiped their gods all around this countryside. Wouldn't that be convenient? Instead of having to go to one specific place, oh, just go up on the, just there's a hill here, quarter mile out of my, from my house, or a mile over here. It's a lot easier than a 20-mile trip to Jerusalem. Now, first of all, God placed that at Shiloh, but eventually, under David, they moved it to Jerusalem. All of that to say then, that he says, this is where they were to come. They were to come here. Now, this is significant because, again, Israel will fail in this way, and they will start going up on every high hill and under every green tree. It's one of the things that that Jeremiah really chides, God really chides Israel through the prophet Jeremiah about the fact they were doing what the nations did. And they were doing, both Israel and Judah eventually ended up doing this. In fact, after the nation of Israel divided after the death of Solomon, Jeroboam, who had been a military leader that God promised that he would give him those 10 northern tribes to rule, and Jeroboam did not believe God in the end, and so he ends up fearing that the people's allegiance are going to turn back to the house of David if they have to go down there to Jerusalem, which is not in his kingdom. It's in the kingdom to the south. It's in Judah, not up among the 10 tribes that he's governing. And so he sets up two bulls, two calves, one in the south, one in the north. Still don't understand the significance of the bulls and the calf. Aaron made a bull and a calf. Jeroboam makes a bull and a calf. Not for certain exactly the significance of that bull or calf imagery to their idolatry. But he sets him up and he says, it's too far for you to go to Jerusalem. Just go here. Just go here. And when you get over in Kings and Chronicles and you read about what happens, it tells us that that was a great sin which Jeroboam made Israel sin again and again and again because they did not come down here as God dictated in the law. He says that was a great sin. Turn back to the book of Leviticus. The law also was designed to make Israel different. And so in Leviticus chapter 20, verse 22, as he's been going through and giving some very graphic details about things they were not to participate in, he says in verse 22, and you are therefore to keep all my statutes and my ordinances and do them so that the land to which I am bringing you to live will not spew you out. Moreover, you shall not follow the customs of the nation which I shall drive out before you, for they did all these things, and therefore I have abhorred them. Hence I have said to you, you are to possess their land, and I myself will give it to you to possess it, excuse me, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God, who has separated you from the prophets. You are therefore to make a distinction between the clean animal and the unclean, between the unclean bird and the clean, and you shall not make yourselves detestable by animal or by birds or anything that creeps on the ground which I have separated for you as unclean. Thus you are to be holy to me, for I am the Lord. I, the Lord, am holy, and I have set you apart from the peoples to be mine. And the man or woman who is a medium or spiritist shall surely be put to death. They shall be stoned with stones, their blood guiltiness is upon them. But they're to be distinct, different than these other nations were. This is one of the reasons in the New Testament it refers to some aspects of their law. Paul refers to some aspects of the law, aspects that really made Israel very distinct, having to do with clean and unclean things such as this, made them distinct from the Gentiles, and therefore it divided Jew and Gentile. Even in the church they had these problems. So Paul mentions this in Ephesians, he mentions this in Colossians, and in both places he refers to the law, at least in part, as consisting of, the Greek word is dogma, which is a Greek word that referred to that which reflected an opinion. So it was a rule based on an opinion, a command or a law based on an opinion, as opposed to something that we would consider natural order. Now, to give you somewhat of an idea, would you say most people in the world would probably find murder repugnant, especially if it's somebody close to them or somebody they know? Yeah, yeah. How about if somebody cheats on you with your wife, or your wife cheats on you with your friend or something like that? Most parts of the world would consider that repugnant. They steal from you. Would most people find that to be frustrating? Aggravating, yeah. So those are laws that we kind of get that, because those are things that personally kind of hit us where we are. Even though there's a selfish element in it, it still is something that people get. And I don't think necessarily it's what we call a moral compass. It's rather that it's something that we as humans can kind of relate to and go, yeah, that would really tick me off if that happened to me. But to say that I can't eat shrimp, no, I don't care. I don't care for shrimp, but I bet a lot of you do. I like octopus, couldn't eat octopus. A pork tenderloin. Poor people out here in the state of Washington don't know what a good fried pork tenderloin sandwich is, like we do from the Midwest. Couldn't eat those. Couldn't have those because they were unclean. Why? Because God specified they were. They weren't unclean because these people were dumb and they didn't know how to cook meat. They were unclean because God designated them unclean to make Israel different. Why don't you Jews raise hogs like we do? Why don't you Jews eat some pig meat with us like we do? Why don't you Jews come down and have bug meat, shrimp, you know, right? Shrimp, bugs in the ocean. Sorry. Why don't you eat that with us? Because our God says we're not supposed to eat that. It made them different. It made them stand out. It drew a line of distinction between these two groups of people. So they would live physically, they would possess the land, they would be well in the land. And I want to kind of as we draw this part to a close this morning, turn to Deuteronomy chapter 28. Deuteronomy chapter 28. Deuteronomy chapter 28, as God issues the blessings and the cursings, he says, notice this first of all in Deuteronomy 28 and verse 1. Oh, just a moment here before we get this. I'm missing these. This is some photos, mock-ups of this, of what the tent wall around the outside, and then you can see the tent on the inside, and that's where the ark was. Tabernacle. A lot of times, even in some of your modern translations, we still have the word tabernacle. Tabernacle is just an old word for tent. But as our language changed and we used the word tent more than the word tabernacle, we've come to kind of give a spiritual significance to the word tabernacle, although it doesn't have that of itself. Okay, that's something we've done because it's just an old word that we don't use a whole lot anymore. So that's that. There is an image of the ark. One example, I'll tell you, there's lots of ideas of exactly what the ark looks like, because we didn't see that. This is one of the things to keep in mind. When Moses was up on the mountain, God showed him what the ark was supposed to look like. So when Moses gave instructions to them, we have the instructions of this is about the shape, and this is kind of what you're seeing and such. But we don't know precisely exactly what it looks like. In fact, he has the poles by which it was carried pointed in a different direction than many do, which this makes sense because this is the way I always pictured the ark sitting, but it tells us that when they put the ark in, that the poles stuck out through the curtain. So in reality, this may have been this way.
See,
so it might have been in that type of a situation. That might be been the way it was set up. Okay. So Deuteronomy chapter 28 then. Go to verse 1. Now it shall be, if you will diligently obey the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments, which I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. And all the blessings shall come upon you and overtake you if you obey the Lord. Blessed will you be in the city, blessed will you be in the country. Blessed will be your offspring of your body, the produce of the ground, the offspring of your beast, the increase of your herd, and the young of your flock. Blessed will be your basket and your kneading bowl. Blessed be when you come in. Blessed will you be when you go out. The Lord will cause your enemies who rise up against you to be defeated before you. They will come out against you one way, and they will flee before you seven ways. The Lord will command a blessing upon you in your barns. That's where you stored all of these things. And in all that you put your hand to do, he will bless you in the land which the Lord your God has given you. And the Lord will establish you as a holy people to himself, as he swore to you, if you will keep the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways. And so all peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you. And the Lord will make you abound in prosperity in the offspring of your body and the offspring of your beasts and the produce of your ground in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers to give you. Part of the law motivated them by the promise of blessing. The promise that they would be healthy, that their children would be healthy, that their crops would be healthy, that their livestock would be healthy, that their bread bowl would be full, that they would be successful in whatever they did. And anybody that tried to oppose them, they would be defeated. But if we turn down to verse 15, he says, "And it shall come about, if you will not obey the Lord your God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I charge you today, that all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. Cursed will you be in the city, cursed will you be in the country, cursed will be your basket and your kneading bowl, Cursed will be your offspring of your body, and the produce of your ground, and the increase of your herd, and the young of your flock. And cursed will you be when you come in, and cursed will you be when you go out. And the Lord will send upon you curses and confusion and rebuke and all you undertake to do, until you are destroyed, until you perish quickly on account of the evil of your deeds, because you have forsaken me. And the Lord will make the pestilence cling to you until he has consumed you from the land where you are entering in to possess it. And the Lord will smite you with consumption and with fever and with inflammation and fiery heat and with the sword and with blight and with mildew. And they shall pursue you until you perish. And the heaven which is over your head will be bronze, and the earth underneath you which will be iron. And the Lord will make the rain of your land powder and dust. From heaven it shall come down down on you until you are destroyed. And the Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You shall go out one way, but you shall flee seven ways before them. And you shall be an example of terror to all the kingdoms of the earth, and your carcasses shall be food to all the birds of the sky and the beasts of the earth, and there shall be no one to frighten them away. If they disobeyed, if they did not guard the law to see that they themselves kept it, that nobody added to it or took away from it, and to make sure that others followed it too, and that it was enforced. If they weren't doing these things, and it was violated, and that violation went on, God would step in and he would punish them. And certainly the history of Israel is full of their punishment, and we will be looking at those things next week. But God would punish Israel. All the blessings that he'd promised in those first 14 verses, he now promises the exact opposite. But let me ask you a question under law, if you think about this. He starts those curses in our English Bibles in verse 15, and he gives those curses down through verse 68. Okay, so how many verses is that? That's 54 verses, because it starts with verse 15. 54 verses. Compared to 14? In other words, he takes three times as much time delineating the curses as he does the blessings. Why? What do you think is the stronger motivation? A star in the chart? Johnny did a good thing. Look at that. Johnny was good today. We put a star in the chart. When he gets five, he gets to go to the store and buy himself a toy. He gets a pizza party. How well does that work? So that's our world today. We're going to motivate everybody with positiveness. We're all going to be positive. We're going to motivate them positively. People with sin natures. We're going to bribe them into goodness. Well, God promises them blessing. 14 verses. If that works, that should have been the dominant section here in this chapter. But it's not. It's a quarter of the chapter. Three times as much space is given to the curses, because which is a stronger motivation? The carrot or the stick? It's the stick from behind. It's the punishment. It's the penalty for not keeping the law. That is the stronger motivation. We don't understand that in our culture today, because we're trying to encourage and motivate and discipline with positiveness. And as a parent, yeah. You need to be positive with your kids. You need to positively discipline them. No. So, but you do need to be positive. You do need to encourage your kids. There's nothing wrong with that. But don't be mistaken. When you're trying to train people with sin natures, and you're trying to do it without really understanding how grace works, which is where we live today, you can motivate people to good behavior better with the threat of punishment than you can with the promise of blessing. Although even the threat of punishment didn't work with Israel, but that's largely because Israel themselves didn't keep the law. Others didn't enforce it. I mean, it wasn't just enough for you to keep the law yourself. You had to make sure it was enforced with others. And that, again, as I said, probably would have been a very hard thing for these people to do. They were not to forget these things. In fact, flip over to chapter 30 here. Deuteronomy chapter 30. We'll close. As Moses is drawing here, he's at the end of his life. This is kind of really what's happening with Deuteronomy. He's given the law to this new generation just before they roll into the land, and he's not going to go with them. He says in verse 19, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. You choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants, by loving the Lord your God, by obeying his voice, by holding fast to him. For this is your life and the length of your days, that you may live in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give them. Notice what he says, choose life. Okay. People misuse that today in anti-abortion campaigns. This choose life had nothing to do with that. This had to do with you choosing for you to live by obeying the law. That's what this was about. He was setting before them blessing and cursing. They could choose whether their kids were going to live or die by whether they obeyed the law. They could choose whether the livestock was going to live or die by obeying the law. They could choose whether or not their crops would live or die by whether they obeyed the law. They could choose whether they would live or die by obeying the law. God the Father is the owner of the house. Moses is the steward, the manager. Israel is the household, and the rule in that household is to live by this law. To live by this law so that they might live long in the land and inherit the blessings and promises that God had in store for them in that land. That is the essence of the dispensation of law. We will come back and we will look at Israel's failure. Because most of us, if we have read the Old Testament, we know Israel failed, and much of the Old Testament records their failure again and again and again. And we'll talk a little bit about why that was the case.